greeted with loud barking. Two Dalmatians sprang out and hurled themselves against him. Shouting imprecations, the doctor took out two large bowls and a plastic bottle which he unscrewed, pouring water into the bowls. There was an immediate sound of slurping and much wagging of strong white tails. As Dalgletian Father Martin approached, he called out, "Good afternoon, Father. Peter is recovering well. No need to worry. He ought to get out a bit more now. Less theology and more fresh air. I'll just take Ajax and Jasper as far as the mere. All well with you, I hope?"
"Very well, thank you, George. This is Adam Dalgleish from London. He'll be with us for a day or two."
The doctor turned to look at Dalgleish, and while shaking hands, gave an approving nod, as if physically he had passed muster. Dalgleish said, "I'd been hoping to see Mrs. Munro while I was here, but I'm too late. I'd no idea she was so ill, but I understand from Father Martin that the death wasn't unexpected." The doctor took off his jacket, dragged a voluminous sweater from the car, and substituted walking boots for his shoes. He said, "Death still has the power to surprise me. You think a patient won't last a week, and they're sitting up and making a nuisance of themselves a year later, and then you expect they're good for at least another 6 months, and arrive to find that they've slipped away in the night. That's why I never give patients an estimate of how long they've got. But Mrs. Munro knew her heart was in a bad state. She was a nurse, after all, and her death certainly didn't surprise me. She could have gone any time. We both knew that." Dalgleish said, "Which meant that the college was spared the distress of a second post-mortem so soon after the first."
"Good Lord, yes. None was necessary. I'd been seeing her regularly. Indeed, I called in the day before she died. I'm sorry, mister. Was she an old friend? Did she know you were coming to visit?"
"No," said Dalgleish. "She didn't know."
"A pity. If she'd had that to look forward to, she might have hung on. You never know with heart patients. You never know with any patients, come to that."
He gave a valedictory nod and strode off, the dogs leaping and trotting at his side. Father Martin said, "We could see if Mrs. Pilbeam's in her cottage now, if you like. I'll just take you to the door and introduce you, and then leave you together." 13. At St. Mark's cottage, the door to the porch was wide open, and light spilled across the red-tiled floor and touched with brightness the leaves of the plants in terracotta pots which were ranged on low shelves on either side. Father Martin had hardly raised his hand to the knocker when the inner door opened and Mrs. Pilbeam, smiling, stood aside to welcome them in. Father Martin made a brief introduction and left, after hesitating at the door, as if uncertain whether he was expected to pronounce a benediction. Dalgleish entered the small, over-furnished sitting room with a reassuring and nostalgic sense of stepping back into childhood. In just such a room had he sat as a boy, while his mother made her parish visits, sitting, legs dangling, at the table eating fruitcake or at Christmas mince pies, hearing his mother's low, rather hesitant voice. Everything about the room was familiar. The small iron fireplace with the decorated hood, the square central table covered with a red chenille cloth and with a large aspidistra in a green container at the center. The two easy chairs, one a rocker, placed at each side of the fireplace, the ornaments on the mantel shelf, two Staffordshire dogs with pouting eyes, an over-decorated vase with the words "Present from Southend," and an assortment of photographs in silver frames. The walls were hung with Victorian prints in their original walnut frames, "The Sailor's Return," "Grandpapa's Pet," a group of unconvincingly clean children and parents processing to church across a meadow. The south window was wide open, giving a view of the headland, and the narrow sill was covered with a variety of small containers holding cacti and African violets. The only discordant note was the large television set and video recorder dominant in the corner. Mrs. Pilbeam was a short, plumply compact woman, with an open, wind-tanned face under fair hair which had been carefully combed into waves. She had been wearing a flowered apron over her skirt, but now took it off and hung it on a peg behind the door. She motioned Dalgliesh to the rocking chair, and they sat facing each other, Dalgliesh resisting the temptation to lie back and sit it comfortably rocking. Watching him glancing at the pictures, she said, "They were left to me by my gran. I grew up with those pictures. Reg thinks they're a bit sentimental, but I like them. They don't paint like that nowadays." "No," said Dalgliesh, "they don't." The eyes looking into his were gentle, but they were also intelligent. Sir Alred Treves had been adamant that the investigation should be discreet, but that didn't mean secrecy. Mrs. Pilbeam was as entitled as Father Sebastian to the truth, or at least as much of it as was necessary. He said, "It's about the death of Ronald Treves. His father, Sir Alred, couldn't be in England for the inquest, and he's asked me to make some inquiries about what exactly happened, so that he can be satisfied that the verdict was right." Mrs. Pilbeam said, "Father Sebastian told us you'd be coming over asking questions. Bit of a funny idea of Sir Alred's, isn't it? You'd think he'd be happy to leave things be." Dalgliesh looked at her. "Were you happy with the verdict, Mrs. Pilbeam?" "Well, I didn't find the body, and I didn't go to the inquest. Wasn't really anything to do with me. But it seemed a bit odd. Everyone knows those cliffs are dangerous. Still, the poor lad's dead now. I don't see what good his dad hopes to do by raking it all up." Dalgliesh said, "I can't, of course, speak to Mrs. Munro, but I wondered whether she talked to you about finding the body. Father Martin says that you were friends." "Poor woman. Yes, I suppose we were friends, although Margaret was never one for calling in unexpectedly. Even when her Charlie was killed, I never felt we were really close. He was a captain in the army, and she was so proud of him. She said that that was all he'd ever wanted to be, a soldier. He got captured by the IRA. I think he was doing something secret, and they tortured him to find out what it was. When the news came, I moved in with her, just for a week. Father Sebastian asked me to, but I would have done it anyway. She didn't stop me. I don't think she noticed. But if I put food in front of her, she took a mouthful or so. I was glad when she suddenly asked me to go. She said, 'I'm sorry, Ruby, I've been such bad company. You've been very kind, but please go now.' So I went. Watching her all those months afterwards, it was like someone being tortured in hell and not being able to make a sound. Her eyes got immense, but the rest of us seemed to shrivel up. I thought she was, well, not getting over it." "You don't, do you? Not if it's your child. But that she was beginning to take an interest in life again. I thought so, we all did. But then they let those murderers out of prison under the Good Friday Agreement, and she couldn't take that. And I think she was lonely. It was the boys that she loved. They were always boys to her, looking after them when they were sick. But I think they were a bit shy with her after Charlie died. The young don't like to watch unhappiness, and who can blame them?" Dalgliesh said, "They'll have to watch it and cope with it once they're priests." "Oh, they'll learn, I dare say. They're good lads." Dalgliesh asked, "Mrs. Pilbeam, did you like Ronald Treves?" The woman waited before answering. "It wasn't my place to think whether I liked him or not." "Well, it wasn't anyone's place, really. In a small community, it doesn't do to have favourites. That's something Father Sebastian has always been against."
but he wasn't a popular boy, and I don't think he felt at home here. He was a bit too pleased with himself and too critical about other people. That usually comes from insecurity, doesn't it? And he never let us forget that his father was rich. Was he particularly friendly with Mrs. Munro, do you know? With Margaret? Well, I suppose you could say he was. He used to call there quite a bit, I do know that. The students are only supposed to go to the cottages by invitation, but I have a feeling he used to drop in on Margaret. Not that she ever complained. I can't think what they found to talk about. Maybe they both liked the company. Did Mrs. Munro ever speak to you about finding the body? Not much, and I didn't like to ask. Of course, it all came out at the inquest, and I read about it in the papers, but I didn't go. Everyone else here was talking about it, though not when Father Sebastian was within earshot. He hates gossips. But I suppose I got all the details one way or another. Not that there were many to get. Did she tell you that she was writing an account of it? No, she didn't. But I'm not surprised. She was a great one for writing, was Margaret. Before Charlie was killed, she used to write to him every week. When I came in to see her, she'd be sitting at the table writing away page after page. But she never told me she was writing about young Ronald. Now, why would she want to do that? You found her body, didn't you, when she had her heart attack? What happened then, Mrs. Pilbeam? Well, I saw her light on when I went over to the college just after six. I hadn't seen her for a couple of days, not to talk to, and I had a bit of a conscience. I thought I'd been neglecting her and that she might like to come in and have a bite of supper with me and Reg and maybe watch television together. So I went over to her cottage, and there she was, dead in her chair. Was the door unlocked, or had you a key? Oh, it was unlocked. We hardly ever lock our doors here. I knocked, and when she didn't answer, I went in. We always did that. And that's when I found her. She was quite cold, sitting there in her chair, stiff as a board, with her knitting in her lap. One of the needles was still in her right hand, pushed into the next stitch. Of course, I called Father Sebastian, and he rang Dr. Metcalf. Dr. Metcalf had come to see her only the day before. She had a terribly bad heart, so there wasn't any problem about the death certificate. It was a good way for her to go, really. We should all be so lucky. And you didn't find any paper, any letter? Not where you'd see them. And of course I wouldn't go rummaging around. What would I be doing that for? Of course you wouldn't, Mrs. Pilbeam. I just wondered whether there was a manuscript, a letter, or a document on the table. No. Nothing on the table. There was one odd thing, though. She couldn't have been knitting. Not really. Why do you say that? Well, she was knitting a winter pullover for Father Martin. He'd seen one in a shop in Ipswich and described it to her, and she thought she'd knit it for Christmas. But it was a really complicated design. A kind of cable with a pattern in between, and she told me how difficult it was. She wouldn't be knitting it without the pattern open in front of her. I've seen her many a time, and she always had to refer to the pattern. And she was wearing the wrong spectacles, the ones she puts on to watch television. She always wore the gold rim ones for close work. And the pattern wasn't there. No, only the needles and the wool in her lap. And she was holding the needle in a funny way. She didn't knit like I do. She told me it was the continental way. Very odd it looked. She used to hold the left needle kind of rigid and work the other one round it. I thought at the time it was funny, seeing the knitting in her lap when she couldn't have been knitting. But you didn't speak to anyone about it. What point would there be? It didn't matter. Just one of those odd things. I expect she was feeling ill and just reached for her needles and the knitting and sat down in her chair forgetting about the pattern. But I miss her. It's odd having the cottage still empty, and it seemed as if she disappeared overnight. She never talked about any family, but it turned out she had a sister living in Surbiton. She arranged for the body to be taken to London for cremation, and she and her husband came down to clear up the cottage. There's nothing like death for bringing the family on the scene. Margaret wouldn't have wanted a requiem mass, but Father Sebastian arranged a very nice service in the church. We all had a part to play. Father Sebastian thought I might like to read a passage from St. Paul, but I said I'd rather just say a prayer instead. Somehow I can't take St. Paul. Seems to me he was a bit of a troublemaker. There were those little groups of Christians, all minding their own business and getting along all right, by and large. No one's perfect. And then St. Paul arrives unexpectedly and starts bossing and criticizing. Or he'd send them one of his fierce letters. Not the kind of letter I'd care to receive, and so I told Father Sebastian. What did he say? That St. Paul was one of the world's great religious geniuses, and that we wouldn't be Christians now if it hadn't been for him. I said, well, Father, we'd have to be something, and asked what he thought we'd be. But I don't think he knew. He said he'd think about it, but if he did, he never told me. He said that I raised questions not covered by the syllabus of the Cambridge Faculty of Theology. And those, thought Dalgliesh, after he had refused her offer of tea and cake and left, were not the only questions Mrs. Pilbeam had raised. 14. Dr. Emma Lavenham left her Cambridge college later than she had hoped. Giles had taken lunch in hall and, while she completed her packing, had talked about matters that he said needed to be settled before she left. She sensed that he had been glad to delay her. Giles had never liked her termly absences when she went to give 3 days of lectures at St. Anselm's College. He had never openly objected, probably sensing that she would have seen this as an inexcusable interference in her private life, but he had more subtle ways of expressing his dislike of an activity in which he had no part, and which took place in an institution for which, as a proclaimed atheist, he had little respect. But he could hardly complain that her work in Cambridge suffered. The late start meant that she didn't escape the worst of the Friday night traffic, and the periodic hold-ups left her with a resentment against Giles for his delaying tactics and an irritation with herself for not resisting them more effectively. At the end of last term, she had begun to realize that Giles was becoming both more proprietorial and more demanding of time and affection. Now, with the prospect of a chair in a northern university, his mind was turning towards marriage, perhaps because he saw it as the likeliest way of ensuring that she went with him. He had, she knew, definite ideas of what for him constituted a suitable wife. Unfortunately, it seemed that she filled them. She resolved for the next few days, at least, that she would put that and all the problems of her university life firmly out of mind. The arrangements with the college had started 3 years ago. Father Sebastian, she realized, had recruited her in his customary fashion. Feelers had been put out among his Cambridge contacts. What the college required was an academic, preferably young, to give 3 seminars at the beginning of each term on the poetic inheritance of Anglicanism. Someone with a reputation, or in the process of making it, who could relate to the young ordinands and who would fit in with the ethos of St. Anselm's. What that ethos was, Father Sebastian hadn't thought it necessary to explain. The post, Father Sebastian had later told her, had arisen directly from the wishes of the founder of the college, Mr. Arbuthnot. Strongly influenced in this, as in other matters, by her high church friends in Oxford, she had believed it was important that the newly ordained Anglican priests should know something of the literary inheritance which was theirs.
Emma, aged 28, and recently appointed a university lecturer, had been invited to what Father Sebastian had described as an informal discussion about the possibility of her joining the community for those 9 days a year. The post had been offered and accepted, with the only proviso on Emma's part that the poetry should not be limited to Church of England writers, nor restricted in time. She had pointed out to Father Sebastian that she would wish to include the poems of Gerard Manley Hopkins and to extend the period covered to include modern poets, such as T.S. Eliot. Father Sebastian, having obviously satisfied himself that she was the right person for the job, seemed content to leave the details to her. Apart from appearing at the third of her seminars, where his silent presence had had a somewhat intimidating effect, he had taken no further interest in the course. Those 3 days at St. Anselm's, preceded by a weekend, had become important to her, eagerly looked forward to and never disappointing. Cambridge wasn't without its tensions and anxieties. She had gained her university lectureship early, perhaps, she thought, too early. There was the problem of reconciling the teaching, which she loved, with the need to produce research, the responsibilities of administration, and the pastoral care of students who increasingly spoke first to her about their problems. Many were the first of their family to attend university. They came laden with expectations and anxieties. Some who had done well in A-level found the reading lists dauntingly long. Others suffered from a homesickness they were ashamed to admit and felt inadequately equipped to confront this intimidating new life. None of these pressures was made easier by the demands of Giles and the complications of her own emotional life. It was a relief to be part of the beautifully ordered and isolated peace of St. Anselm's, to be talking about the poetry she loved to intelligent young men who weren't faced with the weekly essay, the half-acknowledged wish to please her with acceptable opinions, and who were unshadowed by the prospect of tripos. She liked them, and, while generally discouraging the occasional romantic or amorous approach, knew that they liked her, were pleased to see a woman in college, looked forward to her coming, and saw her as an ally. And it wasn't only the students who welcomed her. She was greeted always as a friend. Father Sebastian's calm, somewhat formal welcome couldn't conceal his satisfaction at having once again picked the right person. The other fathers showed their more demonstrative happiness at her return. While her visits to St. Anselm's were an anticipated pleasure, her regular and dutiful returns home to her father were never undertaken without a heaviness of spirit. Since relinquishing his Oxford post, he had moved to a mansion flat near Marylebone Station. The red brick walls reminded her of the colour of raw meat, and the heavy furniture, the dark papered walls and net-shrouded windows created a permanent atmosphere of internal gloom, which her father appeared never to notice. Henry Lavenham had married late and had lost his wife to breast cancer soon after the birth of their second daughter. Emma had been only 3 at the time, and it later seemed to her that her father had transferred to the new baby all the love he had felt for his wife, reinforced by pity for the helplessness of the motherless child. Emma had always known herself to be the less loved. She had felt no resentment or jealousy of her sibling, but had compensated for the lack of love by work and success. 2 words had reverberated from her adolescence, brilliant and beautiful. Both had imposed a burden. The first, the expectation of success, which had come to her too easily for her to deserve credit. The second, a puzzle, sometimes almost a torment. She had grown into beauty only in adolescence, and would gaze into the mirror trying to define and evaluate this extraordinarily overvalued possession, already half aware that, while good looks and prettiness were benizons, beauty was a dangerous and less amenable gift. Until her sister Marion was 11, the two girls had been looked after by a sister of her father's, a sensible, undemonstrative, and conscientious woman who was totally devoid of maternal instinct but knew her duty when she saw it. She had provided a stabilizing, unsentimental care, but had departed into her private world of dogs, bridge, and foreign travel as soon as she thought Marion had been old enough to leave. The girls had seen her go without regret. But soon Marion was dead, killed by a drunken driver on her 13th birthday, and Emma and her father were alone. When she returned to see him, he showed her a scrupulous, almost painful courtesy. She wondered whether their lack of communication and avoidance of any demonstrative affection, which she could hardly call estrangement, since what had they been other than strangers, was the result of his feeling that now, over 70 and bereaved, it would be demeaning and embarrassing to demand from her the love which he had never previously shown any sign of needing. And now, at last, she was nearing the end of her journey. The narrow road to the sea was seldom used except on summer weekends, and this evening she was the only traveller. The road stretched before her, pale, shadowed, and a little sinister in the fading light. As always, when she came to St. Anselm's, she had the sensation of moving towards a crumbling coast, untamed, mysterious, and isolated in time as well as space. As she turned along the track leading to St. Anselm's, and the high chimneys and tower of the house loomed blackly menacing against the darkening sky, she saw a short figure trudging about 50 yards ahead, and recognized Father John Betterton. Drawing up beside him, she let down the window and said, "Can I give you a lift, Father?" He blinked, as if for a moment not recognizing her. Then he gave the familiar sweet and childish smile. "Emma, thank you, thank you. A lift will be welcome. I walked further than I intended round the mere." He was wearing a heavy tweed coat and had his binoculars slung round his neck. He got in, bringing with him, impregnated in the tweed, the dank smell of brackish water. "Any luck with the bird-watching, Father?"
"Just the usual winter residence."
They sat in companionable silence. There had been a time when, briefly, Emma had found it difficult to be at ease with Father John. That had been on her first visit, 3 years ago, when Raphael had told her about the priest's imprisonment. He had said, "Someone is bound to tell you at Cambridge, if not here, and I'd rather you heard it from me. Father John confessed to abusing some young boys in his choir. That's the word they used, but I doubt there was much real abuse. He was sent to prison for 3 years." Emma had said, "I don't know much about the law, but the sentence seems harsh." "It wasn't just the two boys. Another priest from a neighboring parish, Matthew Crampton, made it his business to rake up further evidence and produced 3 young men. They accused Father John of worse enormities. According to them, it was his early abuse that made them unemployable, unhappy, delinquent, and antisocial. They were lying, but Father John still pleaded guilty. He had his reasons." Without necessarily sharing Raphael's belief in Father John's innocence, Emma felt a great pity for him. He seemed like a man who had partly withdrawn into a private world, precariously preserving the core of a vulnerable personality, as if he were carrying within himself something fragile which even a sudden movement might shatter. He was unfailingly polite and gentle, and she could only detect his private anguish on those few occasions when she looked into his eyes and had to turn hers away from the pain. Perhaps he was also carrying a burden of guilt. Part of her still wished that Raphael hadn't spoken. She couldn't imagine what his life in prison must have been. Would any man, she wondered, willingly bring that hell on himself? And his life at St. Anselm's couldn't be easy. He occupied a private apartment on the third floor with his unmarried sister, who could charitably be described as eccentric. Although it was obvious to Emma on the few occasions when she'd seen them together that he was devoted to her, perhaps even love was an added burden rather than a comfort. She wondered whether she ought to say a word to him now about the death of Ronald Treves. She had read a brief account in the national papers, and Raphael, who for some reason made it his business to keep her in touch with St. Anselm's, had telephoned with the news. After some thought, she had written a brief and carefully worded letter of condolence to Father Sebastian, and had received an even briefer reply in his elegant handwriting. It would surely be natural to speak of Ronald now to Father John, but something held her back. She sensed that the subject would be unwelcome, even painful. And now St. Anselm's was clearly in sight. Roofs, the tall chimney stacks, turrets, tower and cupola, seeming visibly to darken with the dying of the light. In front, the two ruined pillars of the long-demolished Elizabethan gatehouse gave out their silent, ambiguous messages. Crude phallic symbols, indomitable sentinels against the steadily advancing enemy, obstinately enduring reminders of the house's inevitable end. Was it, she wondered, the presence beside her of Father John, or the thought of Ronald Treves choking his last breath under that weight of sand that caused this upsurge of sadness and vague apprehension? She had never come to St. Anselm's before, except with joy. Now she approached it with something very close to fear. As they drew up to the front door, it opened, and she saw Raphael, outlined against the light from the hall. He had obviously been looking out for her. He stood there in his dark cassock, motionless, as if carved in stone, looking down on them. She remembered her first sight of him. She had stared in momentary disbelief and then laughed aloud at her inability to conceal her surprise. Another student, Stephen Morby, had been with them and had laughed with her.
"Extraordinary, isn't he? We were in a pub in Raiden, and a woman came up and said, 'Where did you come from, Olympus?' I wanted to leap on the table, bare my chest, and cry out, 'Look at me, look at me, some hope.'"
He had spoken without a trace of envy. Perhaps he realized that beauty in a man wasn't the gift it seemed. And indeed for Emma it was impossible to look at Raphael without a superstitious reminder of the bad fairy at the christening. She was interested, too, that she could look at him with pleasure but without having the least sexual response. Perhaps he appealed more to men than to women. But if he had power over either sex, he appeared unconscious of it. She knew from the easy confidence with which he held himself that he knew that he was beautiful, and that his beauty made him different. He valued his exceptional looks and thought the better of himself for possessing them, but he seemed hardly to care about their effect on others. Now his face broke into a smile, and he came down the steps towards her, holding out his hand. In her present mood of half-superstitious apprehension, the gesture seemed less a welcome than a warning. Father John, with a nod and a final smile, pattered off. Raphael took Emma's laptop and suitcase from her. He said, "Welcome back. I can't promise you an agreeable weekend, but it might be interesting. We've got two policemen in residence. One from New Scotland Yard, no less. Commander Dalgleish is here to ask questions about Ronald Treves' death, and there's someone else, even less welcome as far as I'm concerned. I intend to keep out of his way and recommend you do the same. Archdeacon Matthew Crampton."
15. There was one more visit to be made.
Dalgliesh returned briefly to his room, then went through the iron doorway in the gate between Ambrose and the flint wall of the church, and made his way along the 80 yards of track which led to St. John's cottage. It was now late afternoon, and the day was dying in a gaudy western sky streaked with pink. Beside the path, a fringe of tall and delicate grasses shivered in the strengthening breeze, then flattened under the sweep of a sudden gust. Behind him, the west-facing facade of St. Anselm's was patterned with light, and the three inhabited cottages shone like the bright outposts of a beleaguered fortress, emphasizing the dark outline of the empty St. Matthew's. As the light faded, the sound of the sea intensified, its soft rhythmic moaning rising to a muted roar. He recalled from his boyhood visits how the last evening light always brought with it this sense of the sea surging in power, as if night and darkness were its natural allies. He would sit at the window of Jerome, looking out over the darkening scrubland, picturing an imagined shore where the crumbling sand castles would be finally demolished, the shouts and laughter of the children silenced, the deck chairs folded and carried away, and the sea would come into its own, rolling the bones of drowned mariners around the holds of long-wrecked ships. The door of St. John's cottage stood open, and light spilled over the path leading to the neat, wicket gate. He could still see clearly the wooden walls of the piggery to the right, and hear the muffled snorting and scuffling. He could smell the animals, but the smell was neither strong nor unpleasant. Beyond the piggery, he could just glimpse the garden. Neat rows of clumped, unrecognizable vegetables, the higher canes supporting the last crop of runner beans, and, at the end of the garden, the gleam of a small greenhouse. At the sound of his footsteps, the figure of Eric Surtees appeared in the doorway. He seemed to hesitate and then, without speaking, stood aside and made a stiff gesture inviting him in. Dalgliesh knew that Father Sebastian had told the staff of his impending visit, although he was unsure how much explanation had been given. He had a sense that he was expected, but not that he was welcomed. He said, "Mr. Surtees, I'm Commander Dalgliesh of the Metropolitan Police. I think Father Sebastian explained that I'm here to ask some questions about the death of Ronald Treves. His father wasn't in England at the time of the inquest, and he naturally wants to know as much as possible about the circumstances of his son's death. I'd like to talk for a few minutes, if it's convenient." Surtees nodded. "That's okay. Do you mind coming in here?" Dalgliesh followed him into the room to the right of the passage. The cottage could not have been more different from Mrs. Pilbeam's comfortable domesticity. Although there was a center table of plain wood with four upright chairs, the room had been furnished as a workplace. The wall opposite the door had been fitted with racks from which hung a row of immaculately clean garden implements. Spades, forks, hoes, together with shears and saws, while a bank of wooden compartments underneath held boxes of tools and smaller implements. There was a workbench in front of the window with a fluorescent light above. The door to the kitchen was open, and from it came a powerful and disagreeable smell. Surtees was boiling up pig swill for his small herd. Now he pulled out a chair from the table. It rasped along the stone floor. He said, "If you'll just wait here, I'll wash. I've been seeing to the pigs." Through the open door, Dalgliesh could see him at the sink washing vigorously, splashing water over his head and face. He seemed like a man cleaning himself of more than superficial dirt. Then he came back with the towel still round his neck and sat opposite Dalgliesh, stiffly upright, and with the strained look of a prisoner steeling himself for interrogation. Suddenly he said in an overloud voice, "Would you like tea?" Thinking that tea might help to put him at ease, Dalgliesh said, "If it's not too much trouble." "No trouble. I use tea bags.
Milk and sugar? Just milk. He came back within minutes and placed two heavy mugs on the table. The tea was strong and very hot. Neither of them began to drink. Dalgliesh had seldom interviewed anyone who gave so strong an impression of guilty knowledge. But knowledge of what? It was ridiculous to imagine this timid-looking boy, surely he was little more than a boy, killing any living creature. Even his pigs would have their throats cut in the sanitized, strictly regulated killing ground of an authorized abattoir. It wasn't, Dalgliesh saw, that Surtees lacked strength for a physical encounter. Under the short sleeves of his checked shirt, the muscles of his arms stood out like cords, and his hands were rough, and so incongruous in size with the rest of his body that they looked as if they had been grafted on. The delicate face was tanned by sun and wind, and the open buttons of the rough cotton shirt showed a glimpse of skin as white and soft as a child's. Lifting his mug, Dalgliesh said, "Have you always kept pigs, or only since you came to work here? That was 4 years ago, wasn't it?" "Just since I came here. I've always liked pigs. When I got this job, Father Sebastian said it would be all right to have about half a dozen if they weren't too noisy and didn't smell. They're very clean animals. People are quite wrong to think they smell." "Did you construct the piggery yourself? I'm surprised you used wood. I thought pigs could destroy almost anything." "Oh, they can. It's only wood on the outside. Father Sebastian insisted on that. He hates concrete. I lined it with breeze blocks." Surtees had waited until Dalgliesh began drinking before raising his own mug. Dalgliesh was surprised how much he relished the tea. He said, "I know very little about pigs, but I'm told they're intelligent and companionable." Surtees visibly relaxed. "Yes, they are. They're one of the most intelligent animals. I've always liked them." "Lucky for St. Anselm's. It means they get bacon, which doesn't smell of chemicals, or exude that unappetizing, smelly liquid, and properly hung pork. I don't really keep them for the college. I keep them, well, for companionship, really. Of course, they have to go to be killed eventually, and that's a problem now. There are so many EU regulations about abattoirs and always having a vet in attendance that people don't want to accept just a few animals. And then there's the problem of transport. But there's a farmer, Mr. Harrison, just outside Blythburgh, who helps with that. I send my pigs to the abattoir with his, and he always hangs some of the pork for his own use, so I can supply the fathers with a decent joint occasionally. They don't eat much pork, but they like to have the bacon. Father Sebastian insists on paying for it, but I think they should get it free." Dalgliesh wondered, as he had before, at the capacity of men to be genuinely fond of their animals, to have a lively regard for their welfare and minister to their needs with devotion, and at the same time be so easily reconciled to their slaughter. Now he got down to the business of his visit. He said, "Did you know Ronald Treves? Know him personally, that is?" "Not really. I knew he was one of the ordinance, and I saw him about the place, but we didn't really talk. I think he was a bit of a loner. I mean, when I did see him about the place, he was usually on his own." "What happened on the day he died? Were you here?" "Yes, I was here with my sister. It was the weekend, and she was visiting. We didn't see Ronald that Saturday, and the first we knew he was missing was when Mr. Pilbeam came round and asked if he'd been here. We said he hadn't. We didn't hear anything else until I went out at about 5 o'clock to sweep up some fallen leaves from the cloisters in the courtyard and to wash down the stones. It had been raining the day before and the cloisters were a bit muddy. I usually go up to sweep and hose the cloisters after the services, but Father Sebastian had asked me after Mass to hose them down before evensong. I was doing that when Mr. Pilbeam told me that they'd found Ronald Treves' body.
Later on, before evensong, Father Sebastian got us all together in the library and told us what had happened. It must have been a very great shock for you all. Surtees was looking down at his hands, still clasped and resting on the table. Suddenly he jerked them both out of sight like a guilty child and hunched forward. He said in a low voice, "Yes, a shock." "Well, it was, wasn't it?" "You seem to be the only gardener at St. Anselm's. Do you grow for yourself or for the college?" "Mostly vegetables for myself and for anyone who needs them, really. I don't grow enough for the college, not when all the ordnance are in residence. I suppose I could extend the garden, but it would take too much time. The soil's quite good, considering it's close to the sea. My sister usually takes vegetables back to London when she comes, and Miss Betterton likes to have them. She cooks for herself and Father John. Mrs. Pilbeam, too, for herself and Mr. Pilbeam." Dougley said, "Mrs. Munro left a diary. She mentioned that you'd been kind enough to bring her some leeks on October 11th, the day before she died. Do you remember doing that?" There was a pause. Then Surtees said, "Yes, I think so. Perhaps I did. I can't remember." Dalgleish said gently, "It wasn't so long ago, was it? Just over a week. Are you sure you can't remember?" "I do remember now. I took the leeks up in the evening. Mrs. Munro used to say she liked leeks with cheese sauce for supper, so I took some to St. Matthew's Cottage." "And what happened?" He looked up, genuinely puzzled. "Nothing. Nothing happened. I mean, she just said thank you and took them in." "You didn't go into the cottage?" "No. She didn't ask me, and I wouldn't have wanted to. I mean, Karen was here, and I wanted to get back. She stayed on that week until Thursday morning. I went up on chance, really. I thought Mrs. Munro might have been with Mrs. Pilbeam. If she hadn't been at home, I'd have left the leeks at the door." "But she was at home. Are you sure that nothing was said, that nothing happened? You just handed her the leeks?" He nodded. "I just handed them to her and left." It was then that Dalgleish heard the sound of an approaching car. Surtees's ears must have caught it simultaneously. He pushed back his chair with obvious relief and said, "That'll be Karen. She's my sister. She's coming for the weekend." And now the car had stopped. Surtees hurried out. Dalgleish, sensing his anxiety to speak to his sister alone, perhaps to warn her of his presence, followed him quietly and stood in the open doorway. A woman had got out of the car, and now she and her brother stood close together regarding Dalgleish. Without speaking, she turned and began lugging a large rucksack and an assortment of plastic bags out of the car, then slammed the door. Lumbered with the assorted packages, they came down the path. Surtees said, "Karen, this is Commander Dalgleish from New Scotland Yard. He's asking questions about Ronald." She was hatless, her dark hair cropped into short spikes. A heavy gold loop in each ear emphasized the paleness of the delicately boned face. Her eyes were narrow under thin-arched brows. The iris is dark and glitteringly bright. With a pursed mouth heavily outlined in gleaming red lipstick, her face was a carefully designed pattern in black, white, and red. The glance she gave Dalgleish was initially hostile, a reaction to an unexpected and unwanted visitor. As their eyes held, it became appraising and then wary. They moved together into the workroom. Karen Surtees dumped her rucksack on the table. Nodding to Dalgleish, she said to her brother, "Better get these ready prepared meals from M&S into the freezer straight away. There's a case of wine in the car." Surtees looked from one to the other, then went out. Without speaking, the girl began dragging an assortment of clothes and tins from the rucksack. Dalgleish said, "You're obviously not wanting visitors at present, but as I'm here, it will save time if you can answer a few questions." "Ask away. I'm Karen Surtees, by the way, Eric's half-sister." "You're a bit late on the job, aren't you?
Not much point now asking questions about Ronald Treves. There's been an inquest, accidental death, and there isn't even a body to exhume. His dad had him cremated in London. Didn't they bother to tell you that? Anyway, I don't see what it's got to do with the Met. I mean, isn't it for the Suffolk police?
Essentially, yes. But Sir Alred has a natural curiosity about his son's death. I was coming into the county, so he asked me to find out what I could.
If he really wanted to know how his son died, he'd have gone to the inquest. I suppose he's got a guilty conscience and wants to show that he's a concerned dad. What's he worried about anyway? He's not saying that Ronald was murdered.
It was odd to hear that doom-laden word spoken so easily. No, I don't think he's saying that.
Well, I can't help him. I only met his son once or twice when he was out walking, and we'd say, good morning, or nice day, the usual meaningless platitudes.
You weren't friends?
I'm not friends with any of the students.
And if by friends you mean what I think you mean, I come down here to get a change from London and to see my brother, not to fuck the ordinance. Not that it would do them much harm to look at him.
You were here the weekend Ronald Treves died.
That's right. I arrived Friday night, much the same time as today.
Did you see him that weekend?
No, neither of us did.
The first we knew he was missing was when Pilbeam came down to ask if he'd been here. We said he hadn't. End of story.
Look, if there's anything else you want to know, can you wait until tomorrow? I'd like to settle in, get unpacked, have some tea. Know what I mean? Getting out of London was hell. So if it's all right by you, I'll leave it for now. Not that there's anything else to say. As far as I was concerned, he was just one of the students.
But you must have formed an opinion about the death, both of you. You must have talked about it.
Sir Tees had finished stowing away the food and now came in from the kitchen. Karen looked at him.
She said, of course we talked about it. The whole bloody college must have talked about it. If you want to know, I thought he'd probably killed himself. I don't know why, and it's none of my business. As I said, I hardly knew him, but it seemed a very odd accident.
He must have known that the cliffs are dangerous. Well, we all know. There are enough warning notices.
What was he doing on the beach anyway?
That, said Dalglish, is one of the questions.
He had thanked them and was turning to go when a thought struck him. He said to Surtees, the leeks you took to Mrs. Munro, how were they wrapped? Can you remember? Were they in a bag or did you carry them unwrapped?
Surtees looked puzzled.
I can't remember. I think I wrapped them in newspaper. That's what I usually do with the vegetables, the large ones anyway.
Can you remember what newspaper you used? I know it isn't easy.
Then, as Surtees didn't reply, he added, was it a broadsheet or a tabloid? Which newspaper do you take?
It was Karen who finally answered.
It was a copy of the Sole Bay Weekly Gazette. I'm a journalist. I tend to notice newspapers.
You were here in the kitchen?
Well, I must have been, mustn't I? Anyway, I saw Eric wrapping the leeks. He said he was taking them up to Mrs. Munro.
You don't happen to remember the date of the paper?
No, I don't.
I remember the paper because, like I said, I tend to look at newspapers. Eric opened it at the middle page and there was a picture of a local farmer's funeral. He wanted his favourite heifer to attend, so they led the beast to the grave with black ribbons tied to its horns and round its neck.
I don't think they'd have actually led it into the church.
Just the kind of shot picture editors love.
Dalglish turned to Surtees.
When does the Sole Bay Gazette come out?
Every Thursday.
I don't usually read it until the weekend.
So the paper you used was probably the one from the previous week.
He turned to Karen and said, thank you. You've been very helpful. And saw again in her eyes that swift, appraising glance.
They followed him to the door. As he turned at the gate, he saw them standing close together, watching, as it seemed, until they could be sure he had actually left. Then, simultaneously, they turned, and the door closed behind them.
16. After his solitary dinner at the Crown in Southwold, Dalgleish had planned to return to St. Anselm's in time to attend Compline. But the meal, which was too excellent to be hurried, took longer than expected, and by the time he had got back and parked the Jaguar, the service had started. He waited in his rooms until a beam of light fell over the courtyard, and he saw that the south door of the church had been opened, and the small congregation was coming out. He made his way to the sacristy door, where Father Sebastian finally emerged and turned to lock up behind him. Dalgleish said, "May we speak, Father? Or would you prefer it to wait until tomorrow?" He knew that it was the practice at St. Anselm's for the college to keep silence after Compline, but the warden replied, "Will it take long, Commander?" "I hope not, Father." "Then now, if you wish, shall we go to my study?" Once there, the warden took his seat behind the desk and motioned Dalgleish to a chair before him. This was to be no comfortable chat in the low chairs before the fire. The warden had no intention of beginning the conversation or of asking Dalgleish what conclusions, if any, he had reached about Ronald Treves's death. Instead, he waited in a silence which, although not unfriendly, gave the impression that he was exercising patience. Dalgleish said, "Father Martin has shown me Mrs. Munro's diary. Ronald Treves seems to have spent more time with her than one might expect, and it was, of course, she who found the body. That makes any reference to him in her diary important. I'm thinking particularly of the last entry, the one she wrote on the day she died. You didn't take it seriously, the evidence that she had discovered a secret and was worried by it." Father Sebastian said, "Evidence? What a forensic word, Commander. I did take it seriously because it was obviously serious for her. I had misgivings about our reading a private diary, but as Father Martin had encouraged her to keep it, he was interested to see what she had written. Perhaps it was a natural curiosity, although I can't help feeling that the diary should have been destroyed unread. The facts, however, seem to be plain. Margaret Munro was an intelligent, sensible woman. She discovered something which worried her, confided in the person concerned, and was satisfied. Whatever the explanation she was given, it put her mind at rest. Nothing would have been gained, and much harm done if I'd started probing. You're not suggesting that I should have called the college together and asked whether any of them had a secret which they'd shared with Mrs. Munro? I preferred to take her written word that the explanation she was given had made no further action necessary." Dalgleish said, "Ronald Treves seems to have been something of a loner, Father. Did you like him?" It was a dangerously provocative question, but Father Sebastian took it unflinchingly. Watching him, Dalgleish thought that he detected a slight hardening of the handsome face, but he couldn't be certain. The warden's answer, when it came, might have held an implied rebuke, but his voice betrayed no resentment. "In my relations with the ordinance, I don't concern myself with questions of liking or disliking, nor would it be proper to do so. Favoritism, or perceived favoritism, is particularly dangerous in a small community. Ronald was a singularly charmless young man, but since when has charm been a Christian virtue? But you did concern yourself with the question of whether he was happy here. It is not the business of St. Anselm's to promote private happiness. I would have concerned myself had I thought that he was unhappy. We take our pastoral responsibility for students very seriously. Ronald neither sought help nor gave any indication that he was in need of it. That doesn't exclude my own culpability. Ronald's religion was important to him, and he was deeply committed to his vocation. He would have had no doubt that suicide is a grave sin. The act could not have been impulsive. There was that half-mile walk to the mere, the trudge along the shore,
if he killed himself, it could only have been because he was in despair. I should have known this about any student, and I didn't. Dalglish said, the suicide of the young and healthy is always mysterious. They die and no one knows why. Perhaps even they wouldn't have been able to explain. The warden said, I was not asking for your absolution, Commander. I was merely setting out the facts. There was a silence. Dalglish's next question was equally stark, but it had to be asked. He wondered whether he was being too direct, even tactless in his questioning, but he judged that Father Sebastian would welcome directness and despise tact. More was understood between them than was being spoken. He said, I was wondering who would benefit if the college were closed. I would, among others, but I think that any questions of that kind could more properly be answered by our lawyers. Stannard, Fox, and Perronet have served the college since its inception, and Paul Perronet is at present a trustee. Their office is in Norwich. He could tell you something of our history if you're interested. I know that he does work occasionally on Saturday mornings. Would you like me to make an appointment? I'll see if I can get him at home. That would be helpful, Father. The warden stretched out his hand to the telephone on his desk. He had no need to check the number. After he had pressed down the digits, there was a short pause. Then he said, Paul, it's Sebastian Morel. I'm ringing from my office. I have with me Commander Dalglish. You remember we spoke last night about his visit. He has a number of questions about the college that I would be glad if you would answer. Yes, anything he asks. There's nothing you need withhold. That's good of you, Paul. I'll hand you over. Without speaking, he passed the receiver to Dalglish. A deep voice said, Paul Perronet here. I shall be in my office tomorrow morning. I have an appointment at 10, but if you can come early, say 9 o'clock, that should give us time enough. I'll be here from 8:30. Father Sebastian will give you the address. We're very close to the cathedral. I'll see you at 9 o'clock then. Just so. When Dalglish had regained his seat, the warden said, Is there anything else tonight? It would be helpful, Father, if I could have a sight of Margaret Munro's staff record, if you still have it. It would, of course, have been confidential, were she still with us. As she is dead, I can see no objection. Miss Ramsay keeps it in a locked cabinet next door. I'll fetch it for you. He went out, and Dalglish could hear the rasp of the steel cabinet drawer. Within seconds, the warden was back and handed over a stiff manila folder. He didn't inquire what possible relevance Mrs. Munro's file could have to the tragedy of Ronald Treves' death, and Dalglish thought he knew why. He recognized in Father Sebastian an experienced tactician who wouldn't ask a question if he judged the reply would be either unforthcoming or unwelcome. He had promised cooperation and would give it, but he would store up each of Dalglish's intrusive and unwelcome requests until the opportune moment came to point out how much had been demanded, how small the justification, and how ineffective the result. No one would be more adept at luring his adversaries onto ground they could not legitimately defend. Now, he said, Do you wish to take the file away, Commander? For the night, Father. I'll return it tomorrow. Then, if there is nothing else for the present, I'll say good night. He rose and opened the door for Dalglish. It could have been a gesture of politeness. To Dalglish it smacked more of a headmaster ensuring that a recalcitrant parent was finally taking himself off. The door to the south cloister was open. Pilbeam had not yet locked up for the night. The courtyard, lit only by the dim wall lights along the cloisters, was very dark, and only two of the students' rooms, both in the south cloister, showed even a chink of light. As he turned towards Jerome, he saw that two figures were standing together outside the door of Ambrose. One he had been introduced to at tea,
and the pale head shining under the wall light was unmistakable. The other was a woman. Hearing his footsteps, she turned towards him, and as he reached his door their eyes met and for a second held as if in mutual amazement. The light fell on a face of grave and astounding beauty, and he experienced an emotion that now came rarely, a physical jolt of astonishment and affirmation. Raphael said, "I don't think you've met. Emma, this is Commander Dalgleish, who's come all the way from Scotland Yard to tell us how Ronald died. Commander, meet Dr. Emma Lavenham, who arrives from Cambridge 3 times a year to civilize us. After virtuously attending Compline, we decided, quite separately, to walk out and look at the stars. We met at the edge of the cliff. Now, like a good host, I'm seeing her back to her rooms. Good night, Emma." His voice and stance were proprietorial, and Dalgleish sensed her slight withdrawal. She said, "I was perfectly capable of finding my own way back. But thank you, Raphael." It looked for a moment as if he were about to take her hand, but she said a firm good night, which seemed to embrace them both, and went quickly into her sitting room. Raphael said, "The stars were disappointing. Good night, Commander. I hope you have everything you need." He turned and strode briskly across the cobbles of the courtyard to his room in the north cloister. For some reason which he found difficult to explain, Dalgleish felt irritated. Raphael Arbuthnot was a facetious young man who was undoubtedly too handsome for his own good. Presumably he was a descendant of the Arbuthnot who had founded St. Anselm's. If so, how much was he likely to inherit if the college were forced to close? Resolutely he settled at the desk and opened Mrs. Munro's file, sifting through each of the papers. She had come to St. Anselm's on 1 May 1994 from Ashcombe House, a hospice outside Norwich. St. Anselm's had advertised both in the Church Times and in a local paper for a resident woman to be in charge of the linen and to help generally with the housekeeping. Mrs. Munro's heart condition had recently been diagnosed, and her letter of application stated that nursing had become too heavy for her and that she was looking for a residential post with lighter duties. Her references from the matron of the hospice had been good, though not over-enthusiastic. Mrs. Munro, who had taken up her post on 1 June 1988, had been a conscientious and dedicated nurse, but was perhaps a little too reserved in her relationships with others. Nursing the dying had become both physically and mentally too exhausting for her, but the hospice thought she would be able